Near-Death Experience Podcast, an ongoing exploration of spiritually transformative experiences, including NDEs and other phenomena, in order to elucidate the ineffable and better understand our spirituality. All episodes are available at ndepodcast.org. The views expressed and opinions given by the individual hosts and guests are not necessarily those of NDE Podcast, the NDERF, any sponsors, or for that matter, anyone else. In the end, the only opinion that really matters is yours. Welcome to Near Death Experience Podcast, the official podcast and source of audio counts for the Near Death Experience Research Foundation. I'm your host, John Messer. This is the first of the Patreon editions being released on the podcast. As I was preparing it for the show, I noticed that this NDE was also read and commented on by Chaz for item number 322. While it is a bit of a rerun, if you will, it's interesting to see how Chaz's commentary differs between the two readings. You might want to listen to item number 322 again to see the contrast. And remember, while the Patreon editions are now going to be free for everyone here on the podcast, you can still get a free copy of Chaz's ebook, Life in the Spirit World, What Near-Death Experiences May Teach About Life on the Other Side, by contributing on Patreon. Search for NDE Podcast on Patreon or use the link in the show notes or the link on the ndepodcast.org website. Or simply purchase Chaz's book outright or some of his music on our website. Doing so absolutely helps us keep the podcast financially viable. Just click on the store link in our website. And we deeply thank you for it. And now, the NDE of Jennifer V.
Welcome to Near Death Experience Podcast, Patreon edition. I'm Chaz Hathaway, author of Life in the Spirit World, What Near-Death Experiences May Teach About Life on the Other Side. And can I just say thank you, you guys. You guys are my heroes. You totally have made this community into something that is really, really powerful. And I'm going to ask your forgiveness for the background sound. As of today, it is the day after Christmas as I'm recording this. And so my kids are out there playing with their new baubles and I'm left with a little bit of the sense of, you know, the Grinch Who Stole Christmas when he's talking about how the Whos will wake up and they'll play with their things and dings and dongs and all this stuff. It's a little bit like that today. Yesterday was a beautiful, wonderful Christmas day, and we had so much help from people in the neighborhood and so forth. Just an overwhelming response of, I mean, Santa came this year. It took Santa Claus this year, and he came, and it was the kindness of other people that made that so possible. It's kind of the same reflection as what we're experiencing now with the podcast, is that it's the community that turns something with simple good intent into something that is a powerful force for good. And so I wanted to thank you guys so much for your patronage, for your support, and I feel like you guys are the diehard powerhouse of the podcast now. And so I'm very grateful to bring you this first episode of the Patreon edition of the podcast. I will continue to do these additional podcasts every week, and while we have the $50 or more patronage on the Patreon page, and I'm so excited to do that, you guys, and I'm hoping that we can make this something special, and you know, it'll be like the classic versions, but I'm going to pick sometimes some of the ones that I shy away from just because they're either longer or maybe they're, you know, it's the discussion's going to be more involved than what I usually have either time for or whatever, you know, and I'm hoping to make these Patreon episodes just a little bit more than what you get in the regular episodes. And so let me know if that works out for you, or if there's anything you'd like to see changed or added or whatever. I did also want to say before we get into today's experience that we have, as the first post on the Patreon page, if you haven't seen it yet, a link to a free copy of the ebook Life in the Spirit World, the book that I wrote about near-death experiences, as it relates to what we can learn about what goes on the other side, what day-to-day life is on the other side. And while it doesn't go into great detail about some of the other aspects of near-death experiences, such as, you know, the death process, though there's a little bit of that, there is a section in the appendix about reincarnation and some of my thoughts about that. But besides those, it's mostly focused on what is the other side like? You know, what can we expect to see there and be doing while we're there and so forth? Because that's the thing that kind of got this whole project started, was my curiosity about, you know, okay, so there'll be some kind of transition, and I'm excited about that, and it sounds like it's this great experience, as we've learned from the podcast, but also, I want to know, you know, what am I going to be doing on a daily basis, and where am I going to live, and am I going to have, you know, people around me, am I going to have, you know, what's going to be happening, and I say day-to-day basis, I'm not sure how days work on the other side when there doesn't need to be a sun in order to light that world. But anyway, the point was to ask those questions and find responses to them. So there is a free copy of the ebook on the first post on the Patreon page if you have not seen that yet. So wonderful. So let's get started. This experience is by Jennifer on nderf.org. And this is one of the experiences that is classified as an exceptional experience. And I'm not entirely sure what constitutes an exceptional experience. I think it's just beyond the just, you know, floating around your body and then going back in, because some of the experiences are, and that's beautiful. And it's not like this is way wow different than stuff that we've read on the regular podcast. It's not. It's very traditional of that kind of experience, but anyway, it's just a little bit longer, her explanation and some of the aftermath of it and so forth. So here we go. Here's Jennifer. I felt that I had returned home, and I thought, thank God, I'm back. I knew I was right. I just knew I was from heaven. I was then communicating with the most beautiful spiritual being, and I felt that I was in the presence of the Spirit. It only allowed me to see it from the right-hand side and from over my right shoulder. I believed it to be the Spirit of Christ that I met and who talked with me. It was too perfect to be any other. He then said to me, I'm sorry, but you must return. I was immediately angered by this, and I was not willing to agree. I said, no, you do not understand how much pain it is there is down there, and how hard it is to live there. No way am I going back there. Never. No way. The warmth of the light is the best feeling ever that any child or adult could ever experience. No drug or fix on this earth, such as extreme activities or anything else that you can imagine, will ever feel that good. When you feel it around you, it is perfect. That is what I was experiencing. I was able to fly, and I flew up into the heavens. I do not remember just how I knew, but I just knew that this was me. I could still see and think that this is me. Yet I was shown my body below. in the plane in which I knew there is a line between here and there. I could see my limp and lifeless body thrown over the driver of the car. I was asked, "How about now? Do you see now that you must go back?" And I said, "No! You know I'm not happy that down there, and you know that this is my prayer, my one dream answered. I have been begging to come here, home, ever since I left to go down there. I can't stand it, and I'm not going back." Then the voice says to me, "Jennifer, you must go back and help." And I said, "No." Then the voice said that his nose is cut off his face, You will need to go back and help him. He is bleeding to death. I said, "No, let someone else do it. He will be fine without my help. I do not want to go back down there." Then the voice said, "I will tell you what to do. You take off his shirt, and after you pick up his nose up off the floorboard of the car, it will be next to your feet. Place his nose on his face and press it down to stop the bleeding. It's just blood, so do not be afraid. I am with you, as always." I knew I was never alone. From as far back as a child, I could remember. So then the voice said, "Jennifer, you will begin to walk him up the right side of the road, and a car will come. Tell the man to take you to the nearest hospital. Keeping the man calm, go to the ECM hospital where you were born. You know the way, and everything will be all right. You must do this. Do you understand?" I said, "No, I will not go back there. No, no, no." Then the voice says, "You must think about your mother. Think what your death would do to her, Jennifer." "No," I said, "I don't care. I know you love her and she will be fine. There's no way I'm going back." Then I said, "Oh, darn. Okay. I will reluctantly agree. But dang it, it's so unfair. But you know me, and I will go for you. If you really must send me back, I will go for you." "Yes, okay. I will do what you've instructed me to do, because I love you. And I will be with you again someday. However, I won't forget this." Swoosh, I'm back into my body. I raise myself up and look around, seeing how perfectly still my body was. I checked myself out and said, "Okay, I like it. Nothing damaged here. Now on with my work." "Oh yeah, I remember what you last said before I was sucked back into my body. You said I had to come back because I still had work to do here. I'm not finished yet. Okay, now, where is this poor guy's nose? Oh yeah, first I've got to get him out of that shirt. And it's okay, my friend, I'm going to lift and carry you up this road. I need your shirt to hold to your face. No, do not panic. I know what I'm doing. Trust me. I have you, and everything is under control. Trust me. I know God and Jesus, and we have got you a ride. He's pulling up now. Just remain calm and still while I get this poor man who looks afraid to take us to the ECM hospital. We are only 10 minutes away. I promise you everything will be okay." I said to the man giving us a ride, "Look, mister, please just keep your eyes on the road, at least until we get to the hospital." And he said, "Lady, he's bleeding, and he's dying in my car." He was crying. The man driving the car that stopped to help us is afraid and clearly freaking out completely. So I will just keep talking to the both of them, keeping them assured and calm, telling them that all will be well if we follow my instructions. I said, "Please, I know what I'm doing." Which now I'm sure did seem strange, coming from a clearly calm and in control 11-year-old female who had no CPR training or experience in these matters. Yet I did. if you know what I mean. Just another day in paradise, right? The emergency room doctors successfully attach the nose perfectly in place, then grafted skin from his hip. And this guy heals up perfectly, barely a scratch left to notice. So then the emergency room doctor is asking my mom, where did your daughter receive her awesome CPR training? And how did she know exactly what to do at her young age? My mother just shook her head and said, she has no experience of any kind. The doctor then said, well, I placed 2 stitches in the top of her head, and she may have a tiny cut, but nothing to fear, so just watch her for the next 24 hours. Keep her awake tonight and watch her in case she has a concussion. He then said, I'm a medical doctor, and I cannot explain what kind of miracle I just witnessed in this emergency room today, especially the things that came out of your little girl's mouth. And the way she saved this guy's life and calmed everyone around her, it's amazing. Just amazing. I went home and said to God and Jesus too, I was sorry for being so selfish, and to please forgive me. I will do better while I am down here because I know you guys are always with me. And you will always be with me. And I will never die or be alone here or there. I was thankful for the experience, yet I still felt homesick and lonely. As I've always been before the car wreck, which happened for no reason on a clear, beautiful, sunny day. With no one else in sight for miles, we just drove across the road to and into a telephone pole. Then at the age of about 30, I met my dad's brother in a local pharmacy where I was working at the time. After he had just been pronounced dead at where else but ECM Hospital, the same hospital where I was born, and where I took the guy from the car wreck after my near-death experience. My uncle was excited and seemed eager to share his story with the pharmacist. I was then employed under his name. It was Jason. I had no contact with this uncle until I met him in the pharmacy that day. I was working my way through college, and I was also writing all the term papers that I was allowed on ESP and the near-death experience. My life has been so affected by both of these special gifts, so I walked over and asked Jason, can you tell me about your near-death experience for a paper I am working on for college? He agreed to do that. He said that he woke up in the morgue 15 minutes after being pronounced dead, and that he had come back, after being allowed to, from the other side, from heaven, to apologize to his family for not being a better person to them. But he said that he loved it there. He said that he couldn't wait to go back. He remembered how he could fly, and how all of his dreams came true there. He said that it was awesome. And I said, yeah, I know. He said that he planned to go back in about 3 months. In 3 months' time, he died again, this time staying that way. Then a second customer, a longtime friend and customer of the pharmacy, comes into the store one day, pretty much the exact same story. So I asked him to share his experience, and he too had returned to make it up to his wife and son because he was not very nice to them. But while he was dead, he said that he flew across his dream farmland. For both of these men had spoken of the beautiful green grass over there and the awesome feelings that were so good that no human could ever describe them. This man's name was Jack. And my dad, funny enough, also had another brother whose first name was Jack. Now, Jack told me that he loved heaven, and that he also loved flying, and that he wanted to return as soon as possible, and in about 3 months, he would go. So he, too, died 3 months later and stayed on the other side. I bet he is enjoying his flying and his perfect farmland. When I was in college in my late 30s, I hired a tutor to help me with my algebra. and we became close friends very quickly. We spent a great deal of time together, yet were never sexually involved, but we were as close as two people could get. I called it a spiritual love relationship. I vowed never to allow our time as friends to become anything else, and Joe agreed. Joe was the twin brother of one of my best girlfriends from the second grade. Her name is Jackie. One day I told Joe all about my near-death experience. Joe was so surprised and thrilled, and for the first time ever, I found someone who really wanted to know every detail, and he made me promise that it was all true. He loved it, and he said that he would die first, just like his dad had and one of his brothers before him had. I said, "No way, I will die first, Joe, because I am sick of having surgery now, and you're young and healthy." I said, "Anyway, my own mom used to say that she would live to see the holy war of the biblical revelation begin or take place. And my mom said that I will be more than likely, or that I will more than likely die at age 41. And she would laugh about it. So I told Joe that I will be the one who dies first at age 41 years of age, or at 41 years of age, and that I will play practical jokes on him from heaven. So I said, "You remember this discussion, Joe, and if you promise that you believe in God and Jesus, and that you know them, as you have said, and that you know that I can fly, I promise you I will be dead at 41 years of age." And he said, laughing, "I would just like to see your face if all of this comes true, and you, Jennifer, can make flower arrangements with Blue for my funeral." So I agreed, and I said, "Joe, if you die at 41, send me the publisher's clearinghouse van with a check for $10 million, because with all of my medical bills I have, I sure could use it." Laughing. I thought no more of it until last June 2007, when Joe sat down at the age of 41 years of age and died without any forewarning, except what we had discussed over 16 years ago. In every possible practical joke Joe could have possibly played on me, he did after his death, until I remembered our agreement. Also, my dad and his sister went into the hospital 3 years ago, and of course it was that same ECM hospital where I was born. They both had multiple near-death experiences, and as a matter of fact, my aunt, my dad's sister, told me that she was going back there where all the people were, just waiting for her. She told me things she had no way of possibly knowing about my personal life at that time. At her older age, and having not been in contact with me for many, many years, and she had not seen my dad in a couple of years either. However, she told me of her own NDE, and I didn't need to ask her how she saw my home from over there. And it was all ready and beautiful. She also told me the exact proper order of her and her husband's death, and of my dad's and my own mom's and brother's deaths. And yes, they all occurred in the proper order that she revealed them to me from her hospital bed in ECM Hospital. So to make a long story short, if there are only 774 a day in the USA, good, as I do not have time for much more of this stuff. I think I'm going to pause. I think she's referring to the 774 near-death experiences reported a day in the United States. So it's like having been a magnet for NDEs, and when people are dying of cancer or whatever, and they're uncomfortable about preparing to leave this physical world, they seem to be much happier whenever I visit their hospital room, or wherever it is that the person may be. Their families always tell me this. Once I even received a $50 check from a man friend who died of cancer when I needed another surgery. So after his funeral, which I attended, I received the check and a letter from Donald telling me to use the money to get well. so that I could stay and help others by just staying the way I am, honest and down to earth. Well, by now, yes, I am down to earth and very grounded, and I will be for a very long time. It's just a gut feeling. That is the, and she signs it Jenny. So that's the end of Jennifer's experience, or Jenny's experience, as she signs it. Very interesting. And this is one of the kinds of experience that I would consider an evidential experience. In my experience, the evidential accounts are not profound in their evidential nature. So it's not like there's 50 people who see the spirit leaving the body or something like that, or see the thing happen. It's like they have an experience, and when they return, they tell someone something, and then that turns out to be true. Or the person says, I saw this, or I knew that you had experienced this, and they say, how did you know that? And it's very individual situations that make up the bulk of the evidential experiences, and yet there are hundreds of them. There are so many of them, and how many anecdotal experiences does it take to start becoming statistical in some scientific way? You know, at what point can we say this is not anecdotal anymore? There are so many anecdotes that it is now statistical probability that we can predict this and this and this and so forth. At what point does that become the case? I don't know. One of the difficulties with approaching this from a scientific point of view, and many people do try, is that, first off, many of the studies that have been done in the past, and they say, you know, it's found that 25% of X, you know, happens when Y takes place or whatever, and many of those they found, you know what though, those people were just doing the studies until they found the result that was interesting. So they would say, let's run trials of this, and they keep running trials. And the more trials they run, the more amazing it sounds. You know, when they say, you know, 45,000 people, out of 45,000 people, 25% have this. But if at 25,000 people in, they've only got 2% representation, and then maybe they bump into a city whose representative sample totally skews the results, then they find, you know, at some point, well, this seems to be the case. And so it's like, it's the kind of thing that often their stats are thrown off simply by not starting with a solid number. So I don't even know if that makes sense what I'm saying. So let's say I want to find out if, for example, the penny, if it really is 50-50 to get heads versus tails. Now, if I keep, you know, and we'll say I'll start with a minimum of 100 and then I'll keep going in order to increase my, you know, probability results and so forth. And if at 100 it comes out, you know, 53% versus 47% of one or the other, and then I continue into 500, at that point it's 48% and 52%, and then at, you know, 1,000 we're now at 51% and, you know, 49%, and then I keep going, and then right about 10,000 it ends up at 55% and 45%. And then I think that's an interesting result. And so I publish that result saying, actually, it's only 45% chance of, I don't know, heads and 55% chance of tails. That's not a fair assessment because I didn't set out with the idea I'm going to roll it 10,000 times. If I had set out to do it 10,000 times, that would be a notable result, but because I just kept going until I got an interesting result, I mean, you could go into infinity. Eventually, you're going to end up with some interesting results. You know, if I say, of a poll of, you know, 12,723 people, you know, 72% said this, that is great, but why did you stop at that number? Was it because you decided ahead of time that that was the number you would poll? If so, great, you have a result. And of course, there's other factors that, you know, determine it, like how you're deciding who you're polling and things like that. But everything needs to be predetermined without any bias as to what the result's going to be, and you have to approach it that way. And the reason I'm saying all this is because it's very difficult to say, okay, I'm going to take, I don't know, you know, 200 near-death experiences, and we're going to take all the evidences out of those and come up with this, you know, percentage of whatever. It's hard to do that because, you know, for one thing, where are you going to draw your experiences from? Okay, we could get it off of websites, but how do we know that the websites aren't skewed in some way? Maybe this administrator of this website prefers experiences that have these elements but don't have these elements, and therefore there's already results being skewed. So you're going to want to start from a fresh place and say, okay, I'll do my own research and I'll go to these hospitals around the nation and I will contact them in such a way. And what you end up getting most of the time is probably a fair percent of people who are willing to share that they indeed had a near-death experience. And out of those, you have to look at the different things, but you have to say to yourself, I'm going to keep polling until I reach this number. We'll say 1,000 people, okay? And then out of those 1,000, you know, in those 1,000 that I poll, it has to be within the parameters of, you know, this level of diversity of different hospitals and this level of diversity of different ethnic areas and so forth, so that we can get a good representation. And it becomes, it's not that it's impossible to do, it's that it becomes a job that requires a great deal of sponsorship, because, you know, I mean, if I asked you right now, why don't you go do this poll and do this thing, could you do it? Well, you probably got a job, you got a family, you got things to do. And so I would have to offer you, you know, I'd say, okay, for $10,000, will you do this? And you'd have to calculate it and say, well, I'm estimating this will cost this much money to do, this much time. I mean, it's going to take 6 months or whatever. Is it worth it for my job? You know, quitting my job to do this? Probably not. And so basically it comes down to, in order to get the kind of evidential results that we want with near-death experiences, to be able to point to people and say, this is proof, or at least this is, you know, enough that we can create some really deeply scientific explanations for things, it just takes more than the near-death experience community has in resources. We just don't have it. And I kind of figure that the best way that we can get to that point where we have that kind of demand, that universities are willing to sponsor these kinds of things by researchers and so forth, we need to just get the word out and get people interested enough that people are asking questions of scientists. They're asking, and it's common enough to discuss these things and enough interest in these things that universities are willing to sponsor it, because they know that the results, whatever they be, is going to be interesting enough to people to be able to bring that money back into the school for doing the study. That's how studies work, is my understanding. And so, you know, anyway, that was a long way of saying, you know, we don't have enough information that we can yet call this proof. And yet, with so many anecdotal evidences and so many experiences coming in, I think we can predictably say that if one were to do such a scientific study, they would get some pretty awesome results. The question is, what would those results be? We won't know until those studies are done. So, if any of you have sway in the universities, go for it. But this is an example of an anecdotal evidence experience account. And so, you know, enough of that. But there are some really cool things that I find in here spiritually. Jenny is on the other side, and she says she says that it's the feeling is just so overwhelmingly wonderful that the idea of going back is just like, it's not even a question. You're like, no. And yet she has so much love and respect for this person who she feels is the Spirit of Christ, that whether by that she means the Holy Ghost as a separate being from Christ, or whether she's saying it was Christ, I'm not clear, and whether she considers there to be a difference between those two, I'm not sure. My guess is that whatever her belief system is what she felt like, is who she felt like it was. And that's fair. Let's see, where is it that she talks about that? Because, okay, she says, I believe it to be the Spirit of Christ that I met who talked with me. It's interesting that she says, it only allowed me to see it from the right side and from over my right shoulder. So it's like this person, the spiritual being, is at her right, and she can see its profile, his profile, I'm going to say, just because she says she feels it's the Spirit of Christ. She sees his profile, but that's about all. And again, in the spirit world, it seems that other senses besides visual are more important. Namely, for example, the sense of love between individuals is very, very, very powerful and more self-identifying than even a visual representation. So, I would love to know how to have that sense on this earth, but maybe some do, but I don't. I wish I did. Anyway, so she has this spiritual being with her and is guiding her along. And there's a little bit of an argument that ensues about whether or not she should return. This is an interesting example of how, people say, ask, do you always have a choice of whether or not to return? And I have to say, some do, some don't. And this looks like an example of one of those ones where it's not clear whether she actually has a choice or not. But eventually, with coaxing and explaining and showing and all this stuff, she is eventually convinced to come back. Could she have just stuck with her guns and just refused to go back and stayed? I don't know. All we know is that this being wanted her to return and finally convinces her to do so. And when she does, and this is an interesting part that I think is worth reviewing, is that when she does, though coming back was hard and lonely and all that, she is grateful that she did. It's not like she regrets it later in life, says, why did I come back? Why? I mean, she saved a man's life. And while from this perspective of the spirit world and so forth, it's possible she was thinking, well, he can come here and join us here. It's wonderful. And there may have been a little bit of that, but obviously that man still had more to do. And obviously she had more to do. But the coaxing that said, you have more to do, was not enough to convince her. But however, it seems that telling her that man has more to do tipped the scale a bit. She's like, oh, darn. Okay, I will reluctantly agree. But dang it, it's so unfair. And you know me. And I will go for you. If you really must send me back, I will go for you. Basically, she's saying, I love you enough that I will go, but dang it, it's not fair. And then she says, I'll do what you've asked me to do. Which is all he asks. And then whoosh, she's back in the body. She's able to treat this man like a medical professional would, because she's just been instructed by God, basically, how to take care of him. Everybody else is freaking out. The man is kind of freaking out. It's not clear to what point, but she's telling him, don't panic, don't panic. So he's probably ready to panic. The man who stops to make sure everything's okay with these people that seem to be injured is about ready to panic, because he's like, there's a man, this man is dying, he's bleeding, he's dying, you know, in my car. That seems troublesome to a lot of people, you know, and so he's kind of in this frenzy, and she's just telling him, you just keep calm and drive to the hospital. Don't look, you know, over at us to get more freaked out. You just stay focused on the road, get us to the hospital. And he's okay, you know, and just kind of freaks out and goes. And she's, you know, wrapped his shirt around his face, holding his nose onto him. Apparently it got completely torn off in the accident. I mean, pretty serious accident from the way it sounds. And he's bleeding to death. And so she, you know, puts the nose in place to block the blood, as well as probably start reestablishing some nerve endings and so forth, and get it to start healing. And they're able to stitch his nose back on. And I'm sure he probably had a nasty scar from it, but his nose was restored. I mean, and his life was restored, which is the more important thing. And then after that, after it's all said and done, she's kind of like, well, I'm, you know, she, in her prayers, she says, I'm so sorry for being so selfish. You know, please forgive me. And this reflects an interesting thing to me. We have in life a perspective that this life, that this mortal life is really valuable. I mean, when we're in the right frame of mind, I should say, because there are times when we don't feel very valuable, but most of the time we sense that human life is valuable. You know, our movies reflect the idea that I've got to save him, I've got to protect his life, I'll give my life for this person, and that's the hero, the one who is willing to risk their life on behalf of others to save their lives. And, you know, this life is really important. And yet something about being on the spirit, in the spirit form, we're kind of like, hey, I'm happy to stay here. Forget my life. Forget that. And there are some who recognize that this life is really important because of some purposes they had there. They're like, I have to go back for them, for those people, and so forth. But the life of itself does not seem to be sufficient reason for people to want to return to this body. And so, you know, it's tempting reading, when we read these things and study these things, to suggest that this life isn't all that important, or at least that it's not, you know, being in the body is not important in some way other than to fulfill our purpose and then go back. Being in the body, and this is the point I'm trying to make, being in the body, even when we have the perspective of an afterlife and so forth, she says, I will do better while I am down here because I know you guys are always with me. We have a purpose here. This life is valuable. It really, really is valuable. It's important. We should be here, and we are here for a reason. And it's good for us to value this life that we have, to place a really great weight of value on this life while we are here. This is a perspective that we need to have, not just while we're here, but so that when we return, we can remember that perspective and recognize how valuable this life really is. Because when you first go back, blink, and you're in this wonderful thing, you're like, ah, forget it. But then we have this life review, and we see life for what it really is. And it gives us this joint perspective of the spirit world is where our real lives are. This life is incredibly valuable. It's that dichotomy. I mean, that's why we're coming here, to learn lessons, to develop ourselves. And if we were to just, you know, go back and say, good riddance to this life, we may be missing the point. I don't know if that's making any sense, but it's interesting. So Jennifer goes on and has further explanations about some of her after effects, as I would call them. She doesn't use that term, but she talks about you know, people gravitating toward her who have had these kind of experiences. I would be very interested if you as listeners would let me know how much people have gravitated to you, because I have noticed it. All I have to do is say that I study near-death experiences, or that I do this near-death experience podcast, or, you know, even mention a near-death experience of somebody that I know, and they open right up. And people start saying, you know, my dad had this experience. Or, you know, my daughter, when my daughter was a baby, this happened, and so forth. And they suddenly just kind of break out of the woodwork. And they're eager most of the time to share these experiences because it means something to them. Anyway, I feel like I've kind of rambled. I apologize for that, but very valuable, very fascinating, and what an incredible thing to be learning about the other side from the perspective of people who are here on this earth. I think we're in a unique position as researchers of near-death experiences. And I consider all of you near-death experience researchers because you're listening to these things, you're studying these things. You know more about near-death experiences than 90% of the population in general know about near-death experiences. They've heard of light, they've heard of a tunnel, and that's about it. You know, maybe they've heard of God and so forth, but you know more about the details of the near-death experience and what can be expected and whatnot than most people out there, which puts you in a minority that is valuable to help educate the world about these things. So anyway, thank you again, all of you. You guys are just champions. I would love to hear from you more. More experiences that you've had, any comments that you have, and I'd love to put them on the show. Also, don't forget to download your free ebook, the Spirit World, Life in the Spirit World ebook, on the Patreon page. It's the first post, and those posts are only visible to those who are patrons, who are doing some kind of monthly contribution. Let me know what you think. I'll tell you up front too, I've already discovered a couple of editing errors. Nothing big so far, just you know, funny little grammatical things or whatever. And I'm going. What I'm planning on doing is just continuing to update the book as I find things. You know, maybe every couple of months or something, re-upload the book with, you know, any fixes that I found, as well as any new little quotes and additions that in, you know, second, third editions and so forth that I put up in order to keep this kind of a living book. I'm hoping that the site will let me do that. So, you know, let me know if you find things in there that need changing. But hopefully, mostly, I just love to hear if you're enjoying the book. And once again, thank you all for listening, and to you especially, thank you all so much for your patronage and your support.